Maniacs for meat, voracious for veggies. Others are particularly picky. Cereal and bananas only, please, and don't even think about mixing them. But presented with a wide variety of wholesome foods and allowed to follow their appetites, whether it leads to a mostly empty bowl or a mostly full one, almost all healthy babies eat as much as they need to grow and thrive. No need to keep a running tab or to cram a certain number of servings of each food group into your baby every day. Not only is that a sure way to drive yourself crazy, it's bound to set the stage for food squabbles in the high chair and later at the table. So as you introduce more and more foods into your baby's repertoire, resist the urge to push, measure, or count servings, and instead aim for a mix of good-for-baby foods from the following categories. Protein. Baby's still getting most of the protein he or she needs from breast milk or formula. But since that picture will change once those first birthday candles are blown out, now's a good time for baby to start sampling other protein foods. As they're introduced, these can include eggs, meat, chicken, fish, and tofu. Calcium foods, especially whole milk, cottage cheese, and ricotta, and some grains can double as excellent protein sources. Calcium foods. Again, baby's getting the lion's cub share of calcium from breast or bottle. But baby-friendly calcium foods such as whole milk cheese, cheddar, Munster, Edam, Havarti, baby Swiss, Colby, Jack, for example, and whole milk yogurt, ricotta, and cottage cheese are yummy, nutritious additions and also add protein. Whole grains and other complex carbohydrates. These high chair favorites will add essential vitamins and minerals as well as some protein to baby's daily intake. Good options as they're introduced include whole grain bread, whole grain cereal, baby cereal for spoon feeding, bite-sized cereal for self-feeding, whole grain pasta, bite-sized is typically a big hit, brown rice or quinoa, lentils, beans, peas, or edamame, soybeans, which are also high in protein. Green leafy and yellow vegetables and yellow fruit. There are dozens of delicious vitamin A-rich fruits and vegetables under the green and yellow rainbow. Experiment to see which ones your baby likes. Some to choose from, winter squash, sweet potatoes, carrots, look for yellow and purple ones in addition to the standard orange, yellow peaches, apricots, cantaloupe, mango, broccoli, and kale. Vitamin C foods. Citrus fruits and OJ are obvious sources of vitamin C, and most doctors green light them after the 8th month. Baby can also get an A+ in C from mango, melon, kiwi, broccoli, cauliflower, sweet potato, and many other high chair favorites. Keep in mind, too, that most baby foods and juices are enriched with vitamin C. Read labels to be sure. Other fruits and vegetables. Still room in that cute little tummy? Fill it up with any of the following. Unsweetened applesauce, banana, peas or green beans, and potatoes. High-fat foods. Babies who get most of their calories from breast milk or formula get all the fat and cholesterol they need. As they switch to a more varied diet and spend less time at breast or bottle, it's important to make sure the fat and cholesterol intake doesn't dip too low. That's why most dairy products, cottage cheese, yogurt, hard cheese, you serve baby, should be full fat or made from whole milk. You can also add a healthy dose of fat by serving avocado or cooking with canola or olive oil. Unhealthy fats, those found in fried and many processed foods, are another story, however. Loading baby up with those hard-to-digest fats can lead to an unbalanced diet, unneeded pounds, and tummy troubles. It can also set up unhealthy eating habits that'll be hard to break later on. Iron-rich foods. Bottle-fed babies get their full share of iron from fortified formula, but after 4 months, breastfed babies need another source. Fortified baby cereal can fill the bill easily, and additional iron can come from iron-rich foods, such as meat, egg yolks, wheat germ, whole grain breads and cereals, and cooked dried peas and other legumes, as they're introduced into the diet. Serving up iron-rich foods with a side of vitamin C, a little mango alongside baby's oatmeal, for instance, increases absorption of this important mineral. Omega-3 fatty acids. Part of the family of essential fatty acids, omega-3s, including DHA, are vital for your infant's growth, vision, and optimal brain development. More than living up to their headline-making reputation as baby brain food. These fabulous fats are served up naturally in breast milk, but are also used to enrich some formulas and baby foods. Once baby's eating repertoire expands, you can add other foods high in omega-3 fatty acids, such as fish, like salmon, grass-fed meat, tofu, flaxseed, and canola oil, and DHA-enriched yogurt, cereal, and eggs. Fluids. During the first 5 to 6 months of life, virtually all of the baby's fluids come from bottle or breast. No supplementary water is needed. Now small amounts will start to come from other sources, such as juicy fruits and vegetables, as well as, of course, sips of water. As the quantity of formula or breast milk taken begins to decrease, it's important to be sure that the total fluid intake doesn't. In hot weather, it should increase, so offer water when temperatures soar. Vitamin supplement. Many doctors recommend giving a vitamin supplement. If your baby's doctor does, or if you'll feel better giving it as nutritional insurance, make sure you choose a formula that fits your baby's needs. Getting a head start on healthy eating habits. With just a couple of months of solids experience logged in, your baby's eating habits are still putty in your hands, and sweet squash squeezed between those curious fingers. But they're already beginning to form. Taste may continue to evolve as the months and years pass, but research consistently shows that much of what is learned in the high chair sticks for a lifetime. Which means that you now have the opportunity of a lifetime, your baby's lifetime that is, to help your little one form a future of healthy eating habits. Habits that can actually help shape a longer, healthier future. To get your little one's eating habits off to the healthiest head start possible, start with these healthy feeding basics. Keep white out of sight most of the time. You may already know that not all carbohydrates are created equal, nutritionally speaking. Complex carbs provide a wide range of naturally occurring nutrients. Nutrients that are stripped away during the refining process, the process that makes whole grains white. And nutrients that fuel your little one's growth and development. They're rich in naturally occurring fiber, too, and keep blood sugar steady. That's a compelling case for selecting 100% whole grain pasta, bread, cereal, rice, and crackers at the supermarket. And when you're mixing up muffins or whisking up waffles at home, reaching for the whole grain flour instead of the white. A whole grain habit that's ingrained early is likely to go the distance, helping your little one make smart food choices later on in life. As in, I'll have mine on whole wheat, please. Hold off on cutting that sweet tooth. Babies are certainly plenty sweet without added sugar, but that's not the only reason to skip the sugary sweets for now, and even to consider them and the mostly empty calories they offer off the menu entirely, or mostly, until baby's birthday or even beyond. While baby taste buds may have a natural affinity for sweet, after all breast milk is naturally sweet, they're more open to other flavors, sharp, tangy, tart, even bitter if they haven't been sweet-talked by sugar-added treats. No need to ban bananas, peaches, or other naturally sweet baby favorites. They're a yummy way to serve up nutrients. But as you're building baby's flavor foundation, avoid sweetening everything he or she eats with fruit. Your little one may surprise you by lapping up tangy plain Greek yogurt or gobbling up whole grain cereal without applesauce. Were you raised to expect a sweet ending to every meal and sweets to reward every accomplishment and celebrate every occasion? Consider breaking the dessert cycle, or at least limiting it, and thinking beyond the cookie jar when it comes to rewards and celebrations. Also remember that babies who haven't sampled their first cupcake don't care a lick about frosting yet. And it could be argued, that's sweet. Save the salt, but not the spice. Babies don't need salt in their foods beyond what's found there naturally. And sparing the salt now will keep your little one from craving it later, a habit that's strongly associated with an increased risk of stroke and heart disease. So skip the salt when you're preparing baby food or table foods your little one may be sampling. The rest of the family can always add a sprinkle to taste. And when choosing prepared baby or toddler food, look for ones with no salt added. But while you're holding the salt, don't hold the flavor. Challenge your little one's taste buds with cinnamon, nutmeg, ginger, garlic, basil, dill, oregano, chives, pepper, and curry powder. Mix it up with variety. Who says baby food has to be bland and boring and taste like, well, baby food? You'll both have more fun if you mix it up at mealtimes. So be adventurous. Think outside the baby food box or jar or pouch with an age-appropriate guideline set by the pediatrician. Try dairy products in different forms. Yogurt, cottage cheese, jack, cheddar, grated Parmesan. Vary vegetables and fruits beyond carrots, peas, and bananas. Avocado, soft steamed cauliflower, and asparagus. Sweet potato cubes. Minced cooked eggplant. Ripe cantaloupe. Mango, papaya, watermelon, and kiwi. Split fresh blueberries. Grated pear. The gamut of grains. Add ground flax to baby's oatmeal. Go wild with wild rice, as well as black, red, and brown rice. Quinoa, barley, farro, whole wheat couscous, and whole grain polenta. Pick pasta made with whole wheat, brown rice, buckwheat, spelt, kamut, and other whole grains. Take on tofu. Most babies love it straight out of the container. Hummus and tahini, beans and legumes of all kinds, edamame. Spicing up your baby's menu with variety now doesn't mean you'll be spared a finicky eater later. Most little ones play the picky card at some point. But it will set the table for a more adventurous and nutritious eating future. Be a model eater. Want to raise a broccoli buff or a fast food fanatic? A sweet snubber or a devotee of donuts? The apple or the candy bar doesn't usually fall far from the tree. So watch what you eat and what you don't eat. Your baby is watching too and is likely to model your eating habits for better or worse.
Is it done yet? How do you make sure that the dinner you're serving your baby isn't half-baked and potentially harboring germs that could make him or her sick? By taking your dinner's temperature, a high enough temperature means you won't be serving bacteria along with that roast or that fish. The following foods can be considered safely cooked when they reach these temperatures: beef, veal, or lamb roasts, chops, or steaks, medium, 160 degrees, well done, 170 degrees. Ground beef, veal, lamb, 160 degrees. Pork, 145 degrees. Pre-cooked ham, 140 degrees. Whole chicken or turkey, 180 degrees. Ground chicken or turkey, 165 degrees. Chicken breasts, 170 degrees. Stuffing, cooked in bird or alone, 165 degrees. Fish, 145 degrees. Egg dishes and casseroles, 160 degrees. Don't have a meat thermometer handy, or you're at the mercy of a restaurant kitchen? Meat can be considered safe to eat when it's gray or brown. Though if the meat was previously frozen, as in a fast food restaurant, the color test may not be an accurate gauge of doneness. Poultry should have no traces of pink, and juices should run clear. For fish, check to be sure that it flakes and is no longer translucent. Salmon should turn pale pink. What you may be wondering about.
Messy eating habits.
Our baby doesn't eat anything until she's smushed it, smashed it, and rubbed it into her hair. Shouldn't we at least try to teach her some table manners?
Mind your baby's manners or make that her lack of manners? Not surprising. A little one's mealtime MO is more about playing with food than it is about eating it. With at least as much ending up on her, in her clothes, her high chair, and the floor, than in her. That's because mealtimes are no longer just for filling your baby's tummy and her nutritional requirements, at least not as far as she's concerned, but are also about filling her need to explore and discover. As in the sandbox and the bathtub, babies finding out about cause and effect, about textures, about temperature differences. When she squeezes yogurt in her fist, mashes sweet potatoes into the table, slings a glob of oatmeal from her high chair tray, rubs banana into her t-shirt, blows bubbles in her cup of water, and combs crumbled crackers through her hair. It may be a mess for you, but it's a learning experience for her. Is your older baby even remotely ready to mind her P's and Q's? And really, does it matter if her elbows are on the table, if those elbows are coated in cheese sauce anyway? Probably not. She's at least a year away from having the developmental ability to self-feed neatly, to use a napkin for anything but peekaboo, or to gum her food with her mouth closed. Your best strategy at this point is to model the manners you'd like to one day, one fairly distant day, see her bring to the table, and occasionally point them out. See, I put a napkin on my lap. She'll master them eventually. In the meantime, while you're waiting out the messy eating habits, your first impulse might be to take control and take over feedings. While that strategy might result in neater mealtimes, it'll also result in a frustrated baby, one who doesn't get to flex her self-feeding muscles. Instead, there are plenty of ways you can minimize the mess at mealtime without squashing all the learning fun. Here's how. Protect. An ounce of protection is worth a pound of paper towels, and it's a lot more planet-friendly. Use all the protective measures available to you. Put a splat mat under and around the base of the high chair or table to be wiped down after the meal. Outfit baby in a wipe-clean bib that covers her front and shoulders. A spill-catching pocket which keeps the cereal and sweet potatoes from landing on her legs and the floor is a plus. Roll baby sleeves up past the elbow to keep them dry and relatively clean. Or, room temperature permitting, dress baby only in a diaper and bib at feeding time. Ration. Place just a few bites in front of your baby at a time. Not only will she be overwhelmed with a whole meal at once, she's also more likely to fling half of it while munching on the other half. Add more food once she finishes her first portion. Be proactive. You don't want to inhibit your baby's experimentation, but you also don't want to make it too easy for her to play demolition dining room. So serve meals in a bowl rather than a flat plate from which food can be pushed off easily. And preferably, use a bowl that attaches to the high chair tray with suction. She won't be able to fling her cereal across the room like a frisbee. Or serve up food directly on her high chair tray or the table. Use a sippy cup to minimize spills, and when using a lidless cup, something you should offer often so she becomes proficient in drinking from one, put just an ounce of liquid in it at a time. Occupy. Seems like the definition of pointless, but put a spoon in your baby's hand. True, she's likely to use it only to bang on the table, while she continues to use her other hand for food transport. Eventually, though not for some months to come, she'll get the idea of actually using it to eat with. And until then, it may distract her from overturning her applesauce. Offering her a feeder full of banana or avocado is another way to keep her hands busy while you spoon feed her. Stay neutral. Babies are natural born performers. If you respond by laughing at high chair antics, you'll only encourage more of the same. Ditto for warnings to stop that now. Not only won't that curb the behavior, it'll probably step it up. The best policy, don't comment on her lack of table manners, but do reward her with a round of applause when she takes a few neat bites. Call a ceasefire. When your baby spends more time playing with her food than eating it, it's meal over. Headbanging, rocking, and rolling.
My baby literally bangs his head repeatedly on the side of his crib every time we put him to sleep. It seems to calm him down, but it sounds painful to us.
Remember when you used to rock your baby all night long, and often all day too? That rhythmic rocking movement was your little one's ticket to calm back then. And it sounds like it still is now. Except that he's picked up the beat where you've left off and put his own twist on it, adding rhythmic headbanging to the mix. Headbanging like head rolling, rocking, and bouncing, all of which are also common at this age, and more common among boys than girls, is a rhythmic ritual that may stress you out, but actually relieves stress for your tiny rock and roller. Some babies bang only when they're falling asleep, while others bang when they're bored, overstimulated, in pain, from teething, for instance, or an ear infection, or when they're seeking attention. Habits like headbanging speak far louder than words at this point. A little headbanging is unlikely to hurt him. First, because his not yet fully fused skull is built to take it. And second, because babies usually will use only as much force as they comfortably can handle. They're not in the headbanging game to hurt themselves. As with other rhythmic comfort habits, headbanging usually stops without any parental intervention. Many tots will abandon banging in a few weeks or months as they discover other ways to self-soothe, though some will continue well into the toddler years. And while you can't force your baby to give up one of these habits before he's ready, and in fact, the more attention you pay to banging, the more banging you'll get, the following tips may make it easier for both you and your baby to live with it. Answer that call for attention. Extra cuddles, hugs, and rocking, especially at bedtime, can help fill your baby's comfort coffers, minimizing his need to self-comfort with banging. Remember, though, that headbanging is not necessarily a sign that you aren't keeping up with your baby's comfort needs. Even the most well-comforted babies sometimes just need to try a little DIY. Rock out together. Add a beat to your baby's day, and he may not feel as compelled to beat himself up at night. Explore more acceptable, at least to you, rhythmic activities. Rocking him in a glider, or letting him rock himself in a baby rocker, or when he's ready, in a toddler rocking chair. Letting him bang on a play keyboard, or drum, or the classic spoon on pot. Pushing him on a swing, dancing to lively music, or playing patty cake or other finger or hand games, especially to music. A baby movement class can also help him find his rhythm, without knocking his noggin. Tune into triggers. Does he bang when he's overtired? Make sure he's getting the naps and nighttime sleep he needs, preferably on a consistent schedule that meets those needs. Does he bang when he's frustrated or overstimulated? Turn the beat around, diverting him to an activity that's less stressful, more chill. A change of venue may help distract him from banging during the day, especially if it's a transfer to a padded setting, say, to a playmat on the floor. Make time for wind down. Break gradually for naps and bedtime, giving your little ball of energy adequate opportunity to wind down, relax, and release stress before he hits the crib and his head. Seek other routes to relaxation, such as a warm bath, soft lighting and music, quiet cuddles, massage with a lavender-scented lotion, hushed lullabies, and of course, lots of gentle rocking in your arms. Head off any damage. If your baby rocks or bangs in his crib, minimize the risks to furniture and walls by setting the crib on a thick rug and removing the casters so the crib won't bounce across the floor. Place the crib as far from the wall or other furniture as possible. Remember to check the crib periodically for loose bolts, too, if your baby is a banger. Avoid haranguing about the banging. The less fuss you make over your baby's headbanging or rocking or rolling, the less you'll see of these behaviors, and the sooner they'll stop for good. Intervene as needed, but hold the comments. If your baby headbangs or body rocks a lot and it seems to be hurting him or interfering with daily activities, mention it to the doctor. Hair twirling or pulling.
When my baby is sleepy or cranky,
She pulls on her hair. What's that about?
Hair stroking or pulling is another way little ones can put stress relief into their own hands, allowing them to release tension when they're overtired, stressed, or just plain fighting the fussies. It's pretty common, that is, among babies who have enough hair to grab onto, is often accompanied by thumb sucking, and typically isn't anything that needs your attention. In fact, as is true with most comfort habits, the more attention you pay to it, the more you're likely to see of it. If your baby seems to tug her hair hard enough to pull it out, or if she's always so busy hair twirling that she's not putting her hands to other, more productive uses, like playing with toys or mastering new motor skills, it may be time to try a little gentle intervention. Offer her something else to tug on, like a long-haired stuffed animal, or divert her hands in a game of patty cake or the itsy bitsy spider, or just gather her up in a soothing cuddle. Also try the tips in the previous answer, all of which can help her find alternative routes to relaxation and comfort. Biting.
My baby has started biting us playfully, on the shoulder, the cheek, any soft, vulnerable area. At first, we thought it was cute. Now we're beginning to worry that he's developing a bad habit. And besides, it hurts.
Feeling a little bit like a human teething ring? It's only natural for your baby to want to test drive new chompers on every possible surface, you included. But it's also natural for you to balk at being bitten and to want to nip that nibbling in the bud before it becomes a habit. A habit that's not likely to win him friends in the sandbox or score you points with other parents at the play gym or daycare. When babies bite, it starts off as playful and experimental. No harm, no foul intended. In fact, baby bites are always served up without malice. It won't be until your little one develops full-fledged empathy well into the toddler years that he'll have the slightest idea that he's hurting the one he bites. After all, he's bitten down on teething rings, chomped on stuffed animals, and chewed on his crib rail, all without a single complaint. But it doesn't take long for a nibbler to notice that human reactions to biting make for interesting cause and effect, typically encouraging more cause, biting, in the pursuit of more effect, reaction. He finds the expression on mommy's face when he bites down on her shoulder funny, the startled look and mock ouch from daddy hilarious, and the isn't that cute he's biting me from grandma a definite two thumbs up. Even an angry ouch can reinforce the biting habit because baby either finds it amusing or sees it as a challenge to his emerging sense of independence, or both. The best response to a little nipper: swiftly, calmly, and matter-of-factly remove the biter from the part he's biting with a firm, no-nonsense, no biting. You can add biting hurts, but don't preach on. Then quickly divert baby's attention with a song, a toy, or another distraction. Do this each time he bites, and he'll eventually get the message. Does your baby bite when he's tired or wired, frustrated, hungry for attention, or just plain hungry? Avoid those common triggers. Preempt with a nap, a wind down, a change of activity, some quiet cuddles and comfort, or snack. And you'll likely avoid at least some of the nibbles.
Made with the shades. It's the forecast for sunny skies. Though your little one will have it made in the shade, staying out of the sun isn't always practical. You're probably already protecting your baby's tender skin from the damaging effects of the sun with clothing and sunscreen. But don't forget to protect those baby blues, or greens, or browns, too. A wide-brimmed hat that keeps those peepers covered is a good place to start. But also consider adding a pair of sunglasses to your baby's outdoor outfit in sunny weather. Like hat wearing and sunscreen, wearing sunglasses is a healthy habit that's best started early. When buying shades, be sure to choose ones with UV-blocking lenses, which block 99% of both UVA and UVB light. Unlabeled or novelty sunglasses may be cheap, but they're probably worse than no shades at all, since they can provide a false sense of protection. Keep sunglasses from sliding off or from being pulled off, an even more likely scenario, by attaching them to a specially designed child glasses band that you can slip over baby's head.
Blinking. For the last couple of weeks, my daughter has been blinking a lot. She doesn't seem to be in any discomfort, and she doesn't seem to have any trouble seeing. But I can't help thinking that there's something wrong with her eyes.
It's probably more likely that there's something right with her curiosity. Your baby scientist knows what the world looks like through open eyes. Well, what if she closes her eyes partially or opens and shuts them quickly? So she experiments and often keeps up the blinking until the novelty wears off. Squinting is another temporary habit that some babies cultivate, also for the change of view. But if the blinking or squinting isn't accompanied by other eye symptoms, a wandering eye, for instance, a sensitivity to normal, not uncomfortably bright daylight, or red or teary eyes, there's nothing to worry about. Let her get the blinking out of her system without calling attention to it, and she'll move on to another curious new habit before you know it. And of course, if she's blinking outside, it may be because of the sunlight, and that's a good reminder that baby eyes, like grown-up eyes, should always wear protective shades in the sun, haze, and glare. If you're still concerned about your baby's blinking, or if you have any concerns about your baby's eyes, mention it to the doctor at the next visit. Breath holding.
Recently, my baby has started holding his breath when he's crying. Today he held it so long he actually passed out. Could this be dangerous?
With all those nights of checking on your baby's breathing behind you, you might have thought you'd be able to breathe easily now. And after you listen to this, you actually should be able to. In fact, even a baby who turns blue and passes out during a breath-holding session recovers quickly and completely. Breath-holding spells that are triggered by crying, which, as you well know, can be triggered in babies by a variety of factors, from being mad to being frustrated to being in pain, are common and harmless. The crying, instead of letting up, becomes more and more hysterical, at which point baby begins to hyperventilate, then finally stops breathing. Sometimes only the lips turn blue, scary enough but considered mild by breath-holding standards. Less frequently, but even once is enough for a terrified parent who's standing by watching, a baby turns blue all over and then loses consciousness. While he's unconscious, his body may stiffen or even twitch. Fortunately, breathing resumes and consciousness returns in less than a minute as automatic respiratory mechanisms click into place and breathing resumes. The respiratory system's version of autopilot. Long before any harm is done to baby. The same may not be said of your nerves. You may be able to stop a breath-holding episode sooner by blowing on your baby's face or sprinkling water on it. Either may trigger auto-breathing. About 1 in 5 babies holds his breath during a crying spell. Some have only occasional episodes, others may have 1 or 2 a day or more. Breath holding tends to run in families, so check with your parents to see if either of you had episodes when you were tots, and is most common between 6 months and 4 years, though it can occasionally begin earlier or continue later. While you're waiting for it to run its developmental course, don't hold your breath, try to head off some of the crying spells that can result in breath holding spells. Avoid the triggers. You know the drill by now. A baby who is overtired or overstimulated is always more prone to major meltdowns and less able to handle anger, frustration, and pain than a well-rested one. Keep your little fellow mellow and you'll avert some of the meltdowns that lead to breath holding. Keep routines routine. Regular nap times, regular meal times and snack times, and plenty of unwinding as needed will help prevent fits of temper. Choose your battles. Too many no's can lead to too much frustration for baby. When you need to say no, try to offer an acceptable substitute. Get your soothe on. Try to calm baby before hysteria sets in, using music, toys, or other diversions. Or just offer quiet comfort, a cuddle, some gentle rocking, a hushed shh.
stay as calm as you can. If you're worried about crying escalating to the point of breath holding, your first impulse when baby starts howling is, understandably, to panic. But the calmer you stay, the faster your little one is likely to regain his calm. Even if the breath holding has begun, being the calm in your baby storm can help it pass more quickly and return less often. After all, as your little one begins to use breath holding as a parent button pusher, and he will, not playing into his mini manipulations will pay off. What's the point of making a scene if nobody seems to notice? Don't cave after a spell. On the subject of mommy and daddy manipulation, if your baby knows he can get what he wants by holding his breath, he will repeat, repeat, repeat. Some research suggests that breath-holding spells can be a sign of iron deficiency. So check with the doctor to see if your little one's iron supplies could be low, especially if breath-holding doesn't seem to be triggered by a tantrum or other fit of frustration. In fact, giving an iron supplement can sometimes help ease breath-holding even when no deficiency is detected. While passing out during a breath-holding episode triggered by crying isn't considered worrisome, check with a doctor if you need more reassurance. Who wouldn't? Certainly, any loss of consciousness that's not related to a crying spell definitely should be evaluated. For the adoptive parent, telling baby. Wondering when and how you should tell your little one that he or she was adopted? Experts agree that it's never too soon to start gradually introducing the concept, so that it becomes a natural and comfortable part of your baby's life and family story. As natural and comfortable as being born into a family would be. And you can begin right now, while your baby is tiny and still doesn't have the slightest clue of what you're saying. Just as birth parents occasionally talk about the day their baby was born, you can talk about the day you brought your baby home. That was the best day of our lives. Once in a while, when you're gurgling and cooing at your little one, you can say, "We made our family when we adopted you," or "We're so happy that we were able to adopt you and make our family." Though your baby won't be able to comprehend, even in the simplest terms, what adoption means until he or she is 3 or 4 years old, you'll have planted the seed of the concept, which will ultimately make the concept easier to make sense of later on. But don't overdo the comments you make about the adoption. Aim for natural and comfortable, not forced. Another way to help your baby learn about his or her adoption is to create a scrapbook or photo book that commemorates it. You can include pictures and mementos from that first day, as well as some journal entries detailing how you felt when you first met and cuddled your adorable bundle and when you first came home together. If you travel to a foreign country for the adoption, the book is the perfect place to document the journey and to give your son or daughter a glimpse of his or her heritage. If the adoption was open, photos of the birth mother, especially if they were taken with you while you were both waiting for your baby's arrival or just after, can also help make the concept of your baby's adoption more tangible. No matter what you include, looking at the book together is sure to become a favorite activity as your little one grows, a special record of your early days together as a family. Fears.
My baby used to love to watch me turn on the vacuum cleaner, but now he's suddenly terrified of it and anything else that makes a loud noise.
That's because he's wising up. When your baby was younger, loud noises didn't frighten him, even if they sometimes startled him, because he wasn't sophisticated enough to connect loud with potentially dangerous, and potentially dangerous with scary. As his understanding of the world grows, and with it his ability to sort out in his still-evolving baby brain what's a legitimate threat and what isn't, his fears grow too. In other words, while being afraid of a vacuum cleaner may seem the definition of irrational to you, it actually represents a thinking baby's thought process. Temperament may also play a role in fearful reactions. A little one who's high sensitivity may be especially bothered by loud noises, especially sudden ones. There are any number of things in a baby's everyday life that, though harmlessly humdrum to you, can trigger terror in him. Sounds such as the roar of a vacuum cleaner, the whir of a blender, the barking of a dog, the whine of a siren, the ring of the doorbell, the flushing of a toilet, the gurgle of water draining from the bathtub, having a shirt pulled over his head, being lifted high in the air, especially if he's begun to climb, pull up, or otherwise develop depth perception, being plunked down in a bath, the motion of a wind-up or mechanical toy, and much more. Probably all babies experience fears at some point, though some overcome them so quickly their parents are never aware of them. Little ones who live in an especially busy, noisy environment that's always buzzing with activity, say one where there are older siblings and multiple pets, may be less fear-prone, or they may be more likely to experience fears earlier, as well as get rid of them earlier. Temperament also plays a role, of course, as it does in most behaviors. Sooner or later, your little one will leave his baby fears behind, though an early fear of the vacuum cleaner may be sucked up by a somewhat more sophisticated fear, say, of monsters. Until then, you can help your baby cope with everyday fears in these ways. Don't force facing fears. Making your baby come nose to nozzle with a vacuum cleaner won't help him overcome his fear, but it could dial up its intensity. A fear of household appliances you've turned on and off for years without incident may seem unreasonable to you, but with your baby's limited scope of experience, it's very legitimate to him. He needs to confront the noisy beast on his own terms and in his own time when he feels it's safe. Don't make fun. Yes, most everything your baby does is adorable, even his cowering at the sound of the vacuum cleaner's high-pitched hum. But try not to poke fun at his fears, laughing at them, again, as cute as they may be, or calling them silly. Remember, they're real, not silly to him. Do accept and sympathize. By accepting and respecting your baby's fears as real and offering comfort for them as needed, you'll help him overcome them faster. If he wails when you switch on the vacuum cleaner or flush the toilet or turn on the blender, be quick to pick him up and give him a great big reassuring hug. But don't overdo the comfort and sympathy. Otherwise, you may reinforce the idea that there is something to fear. Do build confidence and skills. While it's important for your baby's budding self-esteem to validate his fears, your ultimate goal is to help him conquer them. You can do that by giving him safe opportunities to become gradually familiar with the things he fears, to learn what they do and how they work, and to gain some sense of control over them. Knowledge is, after all, power, even over a powerful vacuum cleaner. Let him touch or study the vacuum when it's turned off and unplugged. He's probably as fascinated with the machine as he is afraid of it. Help him take baby steps towards vanquishing his vacuum fears. After he's become comfortable playing with the dust-sucking beast when it's off, try holding him securely in one arm while you vacuum with the other. If that's out of his comfort zone too, back off and try again another day. Then show him how to turn the machine on himself, with a little help from you if the switch is tricky. If it's the toilet's flush he fears, have him throw a sheet or two of toilet paper into the toilet, then hold him while you flush it down together. Happily waving bye-bye to the TP can make the process seem less menacing. If it's the draining tub, let him watch the water drain when he's safely out of it, wrapped securely in a towel and in your arms. If dogs are his demon, try petting one while your baby watches from a distance and from a safe spot, say in a pair of friendly arms. When he's finally willing to approach a dog in your arms, encourage your baby while you hold him to make nice doggy to a dog you know is gentle and won't suddenly snap.
The baby social scene. Of course, you're still your baby's favorite playmate, but that doesn't mean you have to be the only one. And that might be a relief for you to hear right about now. After all, Entertaining your baby as he or she starts hankering for some extra stimulation can become a growing challenge. Enter the playgroup. While cooperative playing in a group with other babies is more than a year away for the typical 9 to 10 month old, there are lots of perks to these organized baby get-togethers, as many or more for you as for your little one. Advantages of a playgroup include adult conversation for you. Your child's babbles may be the sweetest sounds to your ears, but if you're like most parents, especially stay-at-home ones, chances are you also long for a little adult dialogue. Meeting regularly with other parents will provide you with the opportunity to speak and be spoken to in full sentences. Entertainment for baby. While it's still too early in your child's social career to expect anything close to cooperative play in a group situation, by the end of the first year, most babies become more capable of some type of meaningful interaction with their peers, usually in the form of parallel play, playing side by side. There's also plenty of entertainment value for baby in just watching other babies at play. And if the playgroup is at someone else's house, trying out someone else's toys. Friendships for you both. If the playgroup is a success, your baby may have a chance to pal around with the same bunch of children on a regular basis for years. And if the playgroup is a neighborhood one, many of the same children may end up in your baby's future classes, a familiarity that can breed comfort on that first day of preschool. As for you, the opportunity to create a whole new network of like-minded friends may be especially welcome, particularly if your old social network hasn't entered the baby phase of life yet. Resources and referrals. Whether you're in the market for a new pediatrician or are wondering when and how to wean, chances are a fellow playgroup parent will have advice or a recommendation. Support from those who know. Meeting regularly with other parents can remind you that you're not the only one who is A, a baby who won't sleep, B, no time for romance with your spouse, C, career frustrations, D, a breeding farm for mutant dust bunnies in your living room, or E, all of the above. There are many ways to find a playgroup for you and your baby to join. Ask around. Check out online message boards. WhatToExpect.com links parents locally throughout the country, and Facebook. Look for flyers promoting them in neighborhood stores, your local library, community center, house of worship, hospital, or doctor's office, or check out the local parent's paper. Can't find what you're looking for, or prefer to start fresh by starting your own playgroup? Sign up members by running listings in the above resources. Or, if you're lucky enough to have friends with babies close in age to yours, get them on board. And though flexibility is key to anything that involves babies, especially a group of babies, you may want to consider the following questions before you take the first meeting of your playgroup. What will the age range of children be? They don't all have to be exactly the same age, but this early on, a spread of a few months is better than a spread of a year or more. A relatively close age range will help ensure that junior members will be able to play with the same toys and relate on somewhat the same level. How often will the playgroup meet? Twice a week? Weekly? Every other week? What time and day are most convenient for you and the other parents? Once you pick a schedule, try to hold to it as much as possible. Consistency is an important ingredient in a successful playgroup. Avoiding nap time and typically cranky times, such as late afternoon, is also wise. Where will the playgroup meet? In one parent's home or rotating from home to home? At a local park or community center? Rotating the location keeps things exciting for the baby group members while sharing the responsibilities that come with hosting the group equally. It also means that the children will have a chance to play with plenty of different toys. How many participants will there be? Will there be a limit on the number of parents and babies who can attend? Too many babies, say 15, can make a playgroup chaotic and unwieldy, while too few, just 2 or 3, may provide too little stimulation. Keep in mind that not every member will show up at every playgroup meeting, thanks to colds, doctor's appointments, and other scheduling conflicts. Will there be refreshments? Who will provide the snacks? Will food allergies be respected? Will there be rules restricting junk food? What about snacks and drinks for the grown-ups? Will there be structured parent-child activities, Or will it be a free time for children and social time for adults? Keep in mind that parents may have to spend lots of time serving as referees and peacekeepers until the kids are old enough, think at least 3 or 4, to play nicely on a consistent basis. Will the cleanup be a group effort too? While the little ones may eventually have fun helping put away toys after a playdate, the parents will ultimately be responsible. Will there be guidelines about discipline and behavior expectations? You'll probably want to specify that parents are responsible for monitoring the behavior of their own offspring only. What will the sick baby rules be? It's smart to set a sick baby's stay-at-home statute, but remember that some tiny noses are always running, and some tiny coughs can linger for weeks, even when nothing contagious is afoot. Also keep in mind that colds and other bugs happen when baby worlds collide, and that this inevitability is not necessarily such a bad thing. The more colds a little one has early on, the stronger his or her immune system will become, and the fewer colds will be caught later. The most important rule you can set in a playgroup: make sure that all babies and parents are up to date on their immunizations. Does a playgroup sound too much like hard work for you or your baby? Socializing with other babies is by no means a requirement of the early years, especially not for those still under a year. So don't feel compelled to join or start a playgroup. And if you sign on only to find that you'd rather you hadn't, don't feel compelled to ride it out. Get your social fix and your babies from impromptu playdates or at the playground instead of playing along with the playgroup concept.
Starting classes. I hear so much about classes for babies. I'm wondering if enrolling my baby in one is important for her development.
Music, art, movement, sensory, swimming, and more. There's no shortage of classes available for little ones not yet able to stand on their own 2 feet. But there's no rush to enroll your pint-sized people, especially when you consider that babies develop best and learn best by doing, when they have the time and opportunity to explore the world their way, with just a little help, as needed, from the adults around them. In other words, babies develop and learn best through experience, not through instruction. In fact, being expected to learn a certain way, at a certain time, at a certain place, or at a certain pace, can dampen a young child's natural curiosity and drive to discover. While baby classes are definitely not a developmental must-do, however, they're certainly a can-do. There's no downside to opting out of them, but there can be plenty of benefits in signing up for one or more group baby activities. After all, it's nice, if not necessary, for your baby to have the chance to play alongside other babies her age, and for you to have a chance to spend time and share insights and tips with other parents. Just choose the classes wisely. Opt for those that are just for fun, where your baby can do her own thing, whether it's bob to a beat or tumble around on a playmat, or watch her classmates do theirs. Avoid any class that has a formal agenda or curriculum, and look for a very loose, flexible, no-pressure format. It's always a good idea to check out a sample class before you sign up. To find out what's available where you live, check online, local parents' magazines, community centers, your pediatrician's office, or ask around at the playground. A more ambitious approach: bring the class to you. Some teachers will hold classes in homes, so if you have the space, the inclination, and a group of parents and babies to sign up, that's another way to go.
All about the beginning of discipline.
You applauded wildly your baby's first successful attempt at pulling up and cheered proudly from the sidelines as creeping finally became crawling. Now you're starting to wonder, what was all the celebration about? Along with that impressive inventory of new skills has come an astonishing talent for getting into trouble. If your baby's not adroitly deleting apps on your iPad, he's clicking place your order now on an order you didn't place. If she's not performing tablecloth tricks in the dining room, she's gleefully unraveling whole rolls of toilet paper or industriously emptying the contents of drawers, cabinets, and bookshelves onto the floor. Before, all you had to do to keep both baby and home from harm was to plop him or her down in a safe spot. Now, no such spot exists. Perhaps all this late-breaking mayhem has got you wondering, is it time to start thinking about discipline? Saying no, meaning no, and following through with discipline when your baby doesn't take no for an answer? The answer is a resounding yes. Discipline means teaching, not punishment as you might have assumed. And the timing's just right for beginning to teach your little one some basic differences between what's right and what's wrong. Or really, at this early stage in your baby's evolution as a human being, what's okay to do and what's not okay to do. Well, even a month or two ago, your choruses of no, hot, don't touch, stop now, went in one adorable ear and out the other, your baby's memory is now improving, as is his or her comprehension. Your little one is starting to make sense out of your words, actions, and tone of voice, and to recall them from one day to the next. That's not to say that he or she is ready to live by the rules or even to understand what the rules are yet. It will take years of baby steps before you'll be able to count on your child approximating anything consistent in terms of compliance, impulse control, a moral compass, or good citizenry. But helping your baby take those first steps now can make all the difference later. Here's how to get started. Begin with love. What's the foundation for all effective discipline? Unconditional love, that unbreakable bond between a parent and a child that comes with no strings attached to behavior expectations. The kind of love that's on tap every moment of every day, whether baby happens to be acting like an adorable angel or raging mini monster. And while it's admittedly easier to show the love when your little one is cuddling contentedly in your arms than it is when he's beaning the cat with a block or she's just tossed her sippy cup into a mud puddle, it's that love that provides your baby with a rock-solid foundation good behavior is always built on. Individualize. Every child is different. Every family is different. Every circumstance is different. Although there are universal rules of behavior that apply to everyone every time, no hitting, no biting, there's no one-size-fits-all discipline approach. In figuring out what discipline fits for your little one, you'll have to factor in temperament, yours and your child's, circumstance, discipline in the supermarket may be different from discipline at home, discipline when your baby's down with a bad cold may be different from when he or she is feeling frisky. And what feels right for your family. Just as rules will vary from home to home, how those rules will be enforced will vary too. Set limits. Yes, they fight limits. Yes, they test limits. And yet, believe it or not, little ones crave limits too. Knowing what to expect and what's expected of them, as long as those expectations are fair, consistent, and age-appropriate, makes children feel grounded, secure, and loved, which in turn inevitably makes them better behaved. That said, limits have their limits when it comes to babies, so limit yours to those that matter most. Draw the line in the sand, for instance, when your little one throws sand, or when toy cars are used as projectiles, or when a tug of war over a doll stroller escalates to hair pulling. Or when Junior keeps reaching for your hot cup of Joe. Be consistently consistent. Just as important as setting those few key limits is consistently enforcing them. If you didn't allow baby to play with your phone yesterday, but you're looking the other way today, or if magazine shredding was a no-no last week, but this week it's been mostly ignored, the only lesson your child will learn is that the world is confusing and rules are meaningless, so what's the point of trying to follow them? There goes your discipline credibility. There goes your parental authority. There goes your baby's compliance. Hitting is unacceptable on Monday, then it has to be unacceptable on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday. And it has to be unacceptable whether mommy's in charge, daddy's in charge, or the babysitter's in charge. And yes, even if grandpa's in charge.
If your rules are all over the place, behavior's bound to be too. Doesn't mean you can't sometimes bend non-essential rules or even break them once in a while. Just that a consistently inconsistent approach to discipline can be predicted to fail. Avoid the no game. A constant chorus of no, no, no strips that all-important word of its power fast. Not to mention sets the stage for toddler negativity, which is just around the corner. So choose your battles, with first choice always going to matters of safety and well-being, of people and things, but avoid making everything a battle. You can limit your use of no's by creating a childproof environment in your home, with plenty of opportunities for exploration under safe conditions. Turn don'ts into do's too when you can. This is how we pet a cat, instead of don't pull Fluffy's tail. Along with each no, try to offer a yes in the form of an alternative. No, you can't play with Daddy's book, but you can look at this one. Or you can't empty the cereal shelf, but you can empty the plastic container cabinet. Instead of, no, don't touch those papers in Mommy's desk, try, those papers go in Mommy's drawer. Let's see if we can put the papers back and close the drawer. This win-win approach gets the message across and teaches a lesson without going negative. Keep age in mind. The same standards of behavior don't stand for a 5-year-old who's developmentally capable of impulse control and reason, and an under 1-year-old who clearly isn't. And neither should the same discipline approach. Timeouts, for instance, aren't effective for babies or young toddlers who don't yet have the attention span, memory, or cognitive ability to sit there and think about what you've done. Rules should also factor in the limitations of age. You can expect that 5-year-old not to interrupt you when you're on the phone, at least most of the time, or to put away toys before bed with a reminder. But expecting either of a 1-year-old isn't realistic. Set limits that are age-appropriate, and you're more likely to get the compliance you're looking for. Expect more than your little one can deliver, and you can ultimately expect discipline to fail. Repeat and repeat. Babies have limited memories, minimal attention spans, and nominal impulse control. Disciplining your little one will be a process, a very long and very repetitive process. You told him not to touch the remote? Be prepared to tell him 100 times and to take it away from him each time he goes for it. You told her biting is for food, not for people. That doesn't mean you won't be removing her mouth from your shoulder many times to come. Be patient, persistent, and prepared to repeat the same message. Don't eat the dog food every day for weeks or even months before it finally sinks in. Even once it does, that itchy trigger finger may not be able to exercise restraint when faced with temptation. Don't give up, don't give in, but do give it time. Be the calm in the storm. Yes, you're only human, and you're the parent of a baby who's only human, so you're bound to lose your temper some of the time. But try your hardest to temper that loss of temper, because anger doesn't work with wee ones. When you're over the top angry, you lose patience and perspective, two things you need lots of when you're disciplining a small child. You model a behavior you're always trying to curb in your baby, loss of control, instead of one you're always trying to encourage, practicing self-control. You may even scare your child, and if you're angry a lot, bruise that just emerging sense of self. And here's another important reason why uncontrolled anger is ineffective. It teaches nothing about right from wrong. Screaming or hitting in the heat of the moment may give you a quick release and may even temporarily stun your little one into submission, but it doesn't further your long-term goal of promoting good behavior. In fact, it promotes just the opposite. Screamers and hitters tend to raise screamers and hitters. Check out any playground and you'll see. So be the calm in the storm as much as you can. When your baby has done something that makes you angry, take a few moments to cool down before you attempt discipline. Then respond calmly. Simply explain what was wrong about what your baby did and what the consequences will be. You threw the truck. Trucks are not for throwing. I am taking the truck away. A good example modeled, a teaching moment seized, an action connected with consequence, and best of all, effective discipline doled out. Plus, you behaved like the adult you are. But since you're only human, there'll be times when you can't slam on the temper breaks. As long as the meltdowns don't come too often or last too long and are aimed at your child's behavior, not your child, they won't interfere with effective parenting or even with your overall discipline strategy. When you do lose it, however, be sure to apologize for it. "I'm sorry I yelled at you, but I was very angry." Adding a comforting cuddle and a reassuring "I love you" will let your little one know that sometimes we get angry at people we love, and that's okay. It's part of being human.
Spanking. Don't do it. Let's face it, being a parent isn't easy, and there are some days when it's really, really hard. The days when you're beat, you're drained, when your little one is testing every reserve of self-control you have, and you're edging closer and closer to the breaking point, you feel like you might snap, and maybe you have that impulse to spank. The impulse is a normal one, only natural when you consider that you're only human, as is your baby. And it's especially natural if spanking was used for discipline by your parents when you were growing up. Didn't you grow up just fine? Spanking is, after all, a time-honored disciplinary tradition passed from generation to generation in many families. But nearly all experts agree. It's time to retire spanking for good. Hitting a child, spanking, slapping, or otherwise lashing out physically is, research shows, an ineffective way to discipline. For one thing, it sets an example of aggression most parents wouldn't want their little ones to follow. Numerous studies show that children who are spanked are more likely to use physical force against peers and later against their own children. Another strike against spanking. It represents the abuse of power by a very large, strong party or bully against a very small, comparatively weak one. Definitely behavior you don't want modeled on the playground later on. Finally, spanking may discourage a child from repeating a misdeed, but compliance comes from fear of another spanking, not from the development of self-discipline, which, after all, is the ultimate goal. Unless you plan to follow your little one around for life, he or she will have to learn the difference between right behavior and wrong behavior, not just the difference between behaviors that result in spanking and those that don't. The most important reason not to spank or otherwise strike: it can hurt your baby. Physically, it's just too easy to cross the line from a swat or a slap to something more harmful. Emotionally, spanking can take a toll too, shaking a little one's sense of security and sometimes eroding the bond between a parent and child. Can a child grow up happy, healthy, and well-adjusted despite a few spankings? Absolutely. But with such a compelling case against spanking, why go there at all? The best policy: make no spanking the policy in your home, even on those especially hard days, and there will be many more ahead to test you. For best results, use other, more effective and less risky discipline strategies. And the same goes, even more emphatically, for shaking a baby. Many parents who would never consider hitting don't think twice about shaking, especially in the heat of the moment. But shaking a baby is extremely dangerous and could cause serious injury to eyes and or brain, or even death. So never, ever shake a baby.
Discipline that works. Can't imagine where to start when it comes to choosing discipline strategies for a baby who's not even old enough to understand the rules, never mind follow them. Keep it direct, simple, and easy to follow through on. Catch your child doing good. By calling attention to good behavior, you'll be asking for more. So comment about the nice way your baby turned the pages in a book instead of trying to tear them. Say thank you when your baby hands you a toy to put back on the shelf. Offer praise when he plays quietly with a stacking toy while you sort the laundry. Applaud all efforts to put shredded cheese into her mouth instead of strewing it on the floor. Make the discipline fit. When your baby pulls all the books off the bookshelves, have him or her hand you each one to help you put them back. If your baby throws blocks around, take them away for now. If your baby bites your arm, put him or her down promptly, firmly saying, "No biting. Daddy can't hold you when you bite." Divert attention. For most babies, especially young ones, what's out of sight is quickly out of mind, making distraction an especially smart discipline strategy now. She's throwing a fit on the way to the park? Divert her fortunately limited attention to two squirrels playing on a tree. He's banging a block against your painted pine dining set. Pull out a toy that won't chip the chairs, like a stuffed dog. With distraction, everyone wins. Use your serious voice. When you're telling your baby no, tone matters. Mean what you say without being mean. Bring down your usually high-pitched, sing-song, playful, baby-friendly voice an octave or two to get your little one's attention and to let him or her know that you're all business and the adult in the room. Be firm, but matter-of-fact. Screaming can scare your baby, and too much screaming can eventually